Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. My guest today is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of historical romance. She's also a columnist and a podcast host and one of the most influential voices in Romancelandia. Please welcome Sarah McLean.
Hi, Jess. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. I'm so excited we could do this. So what's weird is I don't think we ever met because I think I was kind of on the going out of Avon when you were coming in. So I don't think we ever actually met.
I don't think so either. I mean, we would, if we had met, I don't know where you are in the world. Where are you in the world?
I am in Texas now, but I was not then. I was like in, where was I? To Arizona.
Yeah. So we, and I'm in New York City. So the only way we would have met is at like a
conference.
Avon party.
Dinner
at a conference.
Or something. Yeah.
I don't think we have. I was thinking about that too today.
Well, because it's like Romancelandia is so much like, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, where it's like, have we met? You know my friend from this, and we used to write for the same. Like,
right.
It's always, like, everyone's connected, but then it starts to, because the other thing is you can meet someone and they could have been under a different name at that time. So it's like,
exactly.
Oh, are you also
well, that's,
Sarah
that doesn't
Smith?
Happen
oh,
as much anymore.
No,
I feel
not so
like
much.
I feel like when did you start?
At Avon, my first book came out in 2005.
Okay, so
eight million years ago.
I started Avon in 2010, so that's like, you know, 20-year difference in romance time. No, but I do think,
dog
I feel
years.
Like, exactly. I feel like, you know, I say all the time, I feel like I could feel the wind on my skirts when I like came in 2010 and the door like slammed shut behind me and suddenly everything was different. So I got that kind of just a peek at what it was like before everything went, you know, indie ebook excitement, and now it's a completely new world. And I feel like changing your name is one of those things that was a real old-fashioned thing to do.
Yeah. And I think also not connecting them. Like if you write something.
Yeah, like hiding it.
Right. Like having or being forced to hide it. Like, there are still people that don't know that I used to be Jenna Peterson. And I'm like, I have literally never kept that secret, but okay. But yeah, I mean, it is something that I think people don't do as much. Even though there are people that do separate out, like, especially if they're writing something super different, right? So if you're writing like super dark thrillers and then you're writing YA romance, like maybe you're not connecting those two things, but you want to have them as separate names. But it doesn't ever seem like it's a secret like it used to be.
No. Not unless, I guess, dark. I guess some people are still doing that in the dark world, but yeah. I mean, there's no, come into the light, everyone.
Yeah. Everyone, come on.
It's
come
fine. On. Also, as a reader, if I'm a Jenna Peterson fan, I want to know Jess Michaels exists.
Yeah. Right.
Because we've spent so much time. I mean, how many names have you've been around as long, you know, longer than me. But how many times do you think to yourself or turn to a friend and say, hey, whatever happened to.
Yeah. So and so.
That person who just disappeared.
Just vanished into the ether.
Yeah.
Never to be heard from.
And I mean, always the answer is, oh, she's writing such and such now under a different name. You know.
Like, so I've missed 11 books this time. Or, you know, I mean, yeah. It's really funny. And it does seem to be, I think it's an interesting way that you put it, that like the door kind of closed behind you, and like, because you were really coming in right on that cusp. That's the cusp that I was leaving out, although I went and I did Samhain for a little while first. I didn't go straight to indie, but there is that shift in that 2010, 2011 arena where all of a sudden people could, they didn't have to do traditional publishing if they wanted to or had the capacity to do something different. They could be successful on their own terms in a different way, and that really changed the whole culture and the whole, you know, sort of complexion of what the industry sort of looked like.
Absolutely. And I do feel like the difference was right there, right around 2010, because my first book came out, Nine Rules came out in March of 2010, and it was out in Borders. I feel like,
Borders.
I know, pour one out for Borders, but I feel like that's the, if you were in Borders ever in your life, like, you are basically an old person.
Yeah, you're an old, what's sad to me is like, people are like, what's Walden Books? I'm like, oh, no.
That's so funny.
I was a Walden Books bestseller once. It was really important.
Exactly.
It's not important anymore.
No one cares.
And you know what really sucks is I feel like Waldens would do really freaking well now.
Oh,
like a little
same.
Bookstore in a mall.
I mean,
it.
I do think we're in a kind of like indie bookstore renaissance, and that means that kind of tiny, like that Walden experience was so great.
It was and, so good.
I mean, ruined by, you know, the bigger stores that just started, they started worrying about, you know, they started worrying about, you know, looking good as well as, you know, selling the books.
Well, and having like the weird, like the experience, right? So you can come in, you can have your coffee and you can sit and you can read a magazine and you can play a game and you can, like it, it became more.
Bookstore as destination for the day.
Right. Yeah. Your destination.
When like any real reader is like, a bookstore is a destination for a day. I don't need a cup of coffee to do that.
In fact, I prefer not. Don't get your coffee
I carb load.
Are you going to ruin that book?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm like prepping before I go to the bookstore.
Yeah,
I have
carb
water.
Load.
Thank
bring
you.
A snack.
I don't need any help. Yeah. Well, the space, and again, I mean, you know, the space now is, it's got to be at least 50% not books.
Oh, you know, at least I would think. I mean, I have to be honest. It's a pandemic here, so
I know
we're
we
not.
Never,
I mean,
I
I'm not.
For a long,
I haven't been in a Barnes and Noble for a long time, but
right.
Yeah, I mean, at least 50%. But yeah, Borders. Remember Borders.
Oh God, I loved Borders. Oh, that makes me sad.
But I do feel like that's the line, right? Like I was in Borders and in ebook, but that first book, I think my sales were like so, so remarkably more in print than they were in e.
Yeah.
Because it was just those, it was still those early days. You know, people maybe had a Kindle, but they weren't reading, they hadn't become exclusive ebook readers yet.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that. Do you feel like even traditionally, I mean, traditionally you're probably, you're I'm sure moving a lot more paperbacks than I as an Indian moving as paperbacks. But do you feel like that split must be leaning more toward ebooks for you?
Oh,
as well?
For sure. Yeah. For sure. And I don't know that that's true of all historical writers. You know, at least anecdotally, that's not what I hear. But for me, I again, probably because I was, you know, a new, you know, younger writer in at a time when ebooks were taking off. And so I think I built an audience that was naturally ebook friendly rather than people who came before me. You know, who predated the ebook, who, you know, had to build a print audience. And then shifting print into e was a, you know, there is a certain percentage of print readers who are never going to do e as a rule.
Right. They won't. And I think that percentage feels like to me, again, anecdotally, that it is larger in historical romance. Like,
seems that way, right? I mean, I mean, I've seen some data that say that that historical readers tend to be older. So that might be part of it, too. Just people who are paperback readers who I don't know if you ever in the Northeast. I mean, I know that you are in Texas. And so you have places like Katie Budget Books there, which is a used bookstore that really specializes in romance. But in the Northeast, we used to have a print, it's sort of small bookstore. It was a chain, and an indie chain called Annie's Budget Books, Annie's Bookstop, I think it was called Annie's Bookstop. And you would bring, I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, I would bring big giant carrier bags full of Harlequins, like to Annie's, and trade them in. You could get points. You know, and it was just a constant rotating kind of lending library of a bookstore. Right. And I think people who grew up doing that in print stick with print. Obviously, not all of them, but many of them.
But there's like, yeah, because there's like a comfort to that. Like that's part of the experience was doing that, like going into a traditional bookstore, like a used bookstore, and sitting there and touching and picking up and looking at spines and opening and trying to find the good parts. Maybe that's just me. like, how far in is the good parts? Okay,
this one. Well, I mean, I also think
150 pages, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is also a piece of it, which is comfort, right? Those mm-hmm. bookstores, the ones that really honor the used romance as a commodity, as sort of something of value, those bookstores made readers feel comfortable, right? It yeah. made us feel like we were going home. I mean, I remember my sister and I used to go to Annie's every other Saturday with our big carrier bags full of books and yeah. make our trade. And it felt, and we never felt judged. And like the women yes. who worked there, because they were all women, the women who worked there, you know, knew what we loved and saved books behind the counter for us. And that kind of curated experience is something that you can only get in a library or an independent bookstore.
Right. Because if you go into, and I mean, this
and now an Amazon algorithm, right? Like,
right.
Or at least early. It seemed like that for a while.
Yeah. I mean, in those early days, I mean, now it's so impacted by, I mean, you see it on your page too. I'm sure it's like, here's the 7,000 sponsored, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, you're not really getting a real.
And they keep moving that line. Oh, so like other people have bought these other books. I love that line, that sort of books,
other books,
people who yeah. have bought this book also bought all these other books, but they keep moving it around on the page.
Right.
Very
frustrating. They want to push the sponsor
exactly,
more.
Of course.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously that's a business decision, but it does is it limits discoverability even further.
Right.
And because there's some people that can't afford to do ads. There's some people, you know, I mean, like there's always something that comes in and takes away the purity of something that worked and then that says, well, let's monetize it, which I suppose is a natural part of capitalism. But, you know,
meh.
Yay capitalism. Ugh.
Yeah, agreed.
So it sounds like you were always kind of a big reader then of romance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sorry. I started, listen to me drink. I started reading romance when I was 10 or 11. I had an older sister who was 9 years older than me. And she was a member of the Harlequin Book of the Month, like the box,
oh, the subscription.
The monthly
yeah.
subscription. And this was back in the day where the monthly subscription was not ebooks. It was print books. And they would come with like a commemorative plate.
Yeah, they were so fancy.
Like something, you would get something great with it, like a mug or like, you know, something fun. And my sister, you know, so she was a member, and she we shared a room. And she would just shove the books that she'd read under her bed. And when she went to college, I like found this treasure trove of books under her bed. And I just, you know, once I started, I never stopped. I mean, I find it difficult to define myself as a romance writer still, you know, 12 years in, because I feel like I'm such a reader. Like, I'm such a fangirl. And I'd rather read a romance novel than basically do anything else. So
really, are you? So does that impact? I mean, it must have impacted how you wrote. So what sort of started you on the path of writing then?
Well,
were you writing as a kid as well?
I mean, I was writing as a kid. Yes, there's this sort of legendary story where I was in the seventh grade and my English class had to write like, I don't know, a 5-page short story or something. And I wrote a 30-page novella. Like, that was basically a straight up romantic suspense, but I didn't know anything about anything. So it was a very sort of weird romantic suspense, but that's what it was. I mean, that's clearly what I was reading at the time. Like, that's yeah. what I had found under the bed. And so, you know, there was, so all the other kids wrote their stories, and their like 5-page stories went up on the outside the room. And my teacher returned mine to me and said she couldn't hang it up outside the room because it had inappropriate content.
Ma'am, it's a romance, ma'am.
I mean, from the beginning, here I am just flying the romance flag. So,
me too.
So that was it. I mean, I never wanted to read or interact with fiction in any way that didn't have a happy ending. You know, my entire life in high school and college of reading, you know, the great works of literature was terrible because, you know, nothing ends happily. All women die. Like, all marginalized people die. And romance was always a respite from that.
Yeah.
And you can tell, don't you find you can tell when you read, like, the people who really, like, grew up reading romance novels? There's, like, there's a different kind of feel to those books. Some are better than others. It's just, like, you can tell when somebody, like, was a real romance reader from the start.
I think that's true. So I didn't actually read romance when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. My mom didn't read it. And so, and I don't have any sisters. My brother is younger than me and he wasn't reading romance. Shockingly. so
too bad. Could have learned, right? A thing or two.
I know, he's missing out. Although actually I think he might read a little bit of it now. So
that's nice.
It's good. But you know, so I wasn't exposed to it when I was a kid the way, you know, I came to it when I was like in college, because I decided,
well,
I would
write.
Well,
that's still one. Kid. I mean.
Right. Now, of course, I'm like, so like I was a child. But, you know, I mean, like those formative. But I do think that there is a difference in someone that kind of grew up on all of that. Like, I think the tropes hit differently when you're 10 or 12. Do you right. know what I mean? Like, it's because it's part of forming your brain in a sure. different way. And so I do think you're right that there's a difference. And again, I don't think there's a value on either of those things, that they're great writers that I mean, there are writers on here that I've talked to that are like me, never read a romance till they were, you know, 26 years old, and they are great writers. And there are people that started when they were 8 and are like, in retrospect, perhaps I shouldn't have been reading that quite that young. But here we are. And they're also great writers. But yes, I think there is a difference in the language of and the understanding of it when you have read it from a really formative age.
Well, I also think that there is a difference in the sense that, so when I think of romance, I think of it a lot as like a giant family tree, right? Like we're all writing on the same tree, but there are very big, you know, there are big trunks and big branches that, you know, that come off the tree. And so I think obviously there are many of us who, you know, cut our teeth on the early books of the modern genre, right? And we read all of those books from the 90s that had Fabio on the cover, right? And I think we, you know, that's one thing. And then I do think that over the last decade or two, again, since I think it's probably close to a decade, it's since like fanfic became a really big thing online. Again, the online has changed the whole world, and of course it's changed romance too. And I think people who came up through fanfic, people like Kat Sebastian and Rebecca Weatherspoon and Christina Lauren and Olivia Dade.
Sulika Snyder.
Yeah, yeah. Sulika Snyder. Well, Sulika is a special case, right? Because she
also
read all those books in the 90s.
Right.
She sort of has it all.
She has, like, all of the magic.
Sure. So like when you're looking at these people who came up through fanfic, like Adriana Herrera, their books read different. Again, like just not bad different, just different. They clearly come from a different school. Right? It's
right.
like looking at a Manet and looking at a Picasso. Like, the two are different things.
Yes. And again, like, it's... I do think there's a level of trope understanding in both of those things.
Of course. In fact,
there's fan fiction trope understanding, and then there's, like, cutting my teeth on Rosemary Rogers trope understanding.
Yeah.
And those are two different things. And then there's another one in the middle, which is more like me, where it's just like I staggered drunkenly into deciding that I wanted to write a book.
Sure.
And then I was like, wow, that's fucking hard. I should probably read some of those more than I have. And stopped being embarrassed about the fact that I did actually like reading them. And then I actually read them.
Sure.
I did it all backward.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, but then I come in from a very different place as well.
Yeah.
So it's like but I do think it's a certain level of trope, I don't know, like manipulation, but I don't like that word because people are going to take it the wrong way. But do you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, I totally do. I mean, I think that it's really interesting because I think those of us who came from like old school, like historicals and contemporaries, that, you know, are when you get into that deep end of the pool, I always recommend that you like think very carefully about the books as like craft rather than content, because there's a lot of problematic shit. Can I say
so
shit?
Much. Yes.
There's a lot of problematic shit down in that end of the pool, right? And so our work is to like build on what we're all doing. And I shouldn't say work, but like when we come at it from that, with that DNA, right, built into us, then our work is to kind of unpack all that baggage, keep the good and sort of leave the bad. And I think that what the people from, say, fanfic are doing is, like, they come with this, like, trope, right? Like, the only one bad trope, or, like, the grumpy sunshine trope, which are so cornerstone to what's happening in fanfic. And their work is to, like, take that trope and then build a story, like, add to it to make a book, right? Mm-hmm. And I think those – I think the work is really fascinating in both places. And, I mean – and then, of course – people, there are lots of other, I'm not arguing that there are only two paths.
Right.
I just think there are two
interesting. But those are like such, huge branches. Paths.
Yeah.
You know, they're so, they have such very clear sort of like boundaries to like, oh, that's what that is.
Yeah.
That I think it's a lot clearer than maybe some more meandering paths that have gotten us there. And they're also like really common paths, because I've talked to so many writers who wrote fanfic or read fanfic, and that was their gateway into romance. And I've talked to so many authors who, you know, were birthed from the womb reading romance, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do think that those of us who were birthed from the womb reading romance are based, for a long time, we wrote fanfic, right? But we wrote fanfic of the books that we loved when we were younger, right? So like my first book is literally the plot of the book is that the heroine makes a list of 9 things she wants to do, like now that she's on the shelf and like before her life is just sort of packed up and sent away to the country. And the 9 things are tropes that I love as a reader, right? Yeah. Like they're just, that's basically what it is. Like open up a vein, Sarah, and pour out the book that you want to read. You know, and I think that's a thing that's specific often to debuts. But in that case, I mean, we're all writing. I think one of the cool things about romance is that it's so iterative. Like we all read a book and then think to ourselves like, oh, this is really interesting. How can I,
yeah,
you know, twist this, change this, put my own spin on this kind of, you know, trope or concept or plot or whatever. And I think that's the joy of romance, is that it feels like all literature is iterative, but like romance is sort of openly so, and I think that's really great.
Yeah, we celebrate that, because I don't know how many times I've, especially if it's a trope that I really like but I haven't ever figured out like how to write it, or I've just never written it, you know, I'll read something and I'm like, oh my god, I really need to write a
how did sunshine. She do how, that what is
that's a, yeah I've forgotten how much I love that, I should do that, like and yeah, it's much more out loud. We don't screech so much about that there's only one person that can write one thing.
No. And I mean, I'm so flattered when people say like, oh, I read this book of yours and then it made me want to write a second chance. Like that's how
it should
be. Yeah,
that's a compliment.
Right? Like, yeah. You know, I read Sally Thorne's The Hating Game like everyone else when it first came out. And I was like, oh, you know what? This is not enemies to lovers, it's rivals to lovers, and that's a different kind of thing, and how can I write rivals to lovers? And, you know, 5 years later, I wrote my rivals to lovers story when I finally, like, had it figured out in my head, and that's because of Sally. And my book is nothing like The Hating Game, but it's inspired by The Hating Game, you know?
Right. Yeah, we take that inspiration a lot more, and I think... Because it feels like when I look, and again, I end up looking from an outsider's view from other places, but it doesn't feel like other genres necessarily embrace that quite so much. That
I think I don't know. I mean, I think it's out loud, right? I also think a lot about those early days of romance. I think romance writes so fast. We write, and even back in the day, those women were writing really fast. Those original
Harlequin ones could really, like, the lines really had an expectation of being able to write fast.
Yeah, like 3 or 4 in a year.
Yeah,
and so this idea that I think we're just not as precious.
Yeah, right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we're like, workhorses. I said to my husband yesterday, like, I don't understand people who write for, like, for cookies. Like I don't understand people who write like just so people can be impressed by them. Like this is a job, and I think the job of it is something that's very genre, right? Yeah, like I think thriller writers think of their job as a job too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. It's a very genre. It's a very genre thing. But because I don't know about you, but I mean, I've written a whole freaking bunch of fucking books, and like people will be like, oh, I just read this book from like 3 years ago and I was wondering why X did Y, and I'm like, I don't even know what the hell you're talking about.
You are so fast.
Like, I have to go back to the document and search for the name. Somebody was like, is so-and-so ever gonna get a book? And I'm like, I have never heard of that person. Are you sure it's me? Because then that's the other thing, is sometimes it's not me.
Right.
And then I'm like, am I going crazy or is that me? Like, am I going crazy and I don't remember? Or like, have just blocked it out? Or is it actually you?
Oh,
that's Sarah. Sarah's book, actually. You should ask Sarah if she's going to write a book.
The answer is definitely not.
If she hasn't done it so far, I'm going to say she's probably not going to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a huge piece of it. It's a really amazing job, and I pinch myself every day that I get to do it, and that people are, you know, still coming to read the books. But it is I do think that people who write genre and romance specifically think about their work in a different way than people who write lit fic, say.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that there's, I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's true.
Yeah. I mean, it probably depends on the writer, right? I mean, like, I don't know. I think the problem becomes when nothing about it is precious. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The act of creation for me is the best thing that I ever do, ever. Like, that's the best thing that I do. Like, it's my favorite part of all of it. Like, honestly, I could leave. If traditional publishing actually worked for me,
right,
I would do it in a heartbeat, because I hate
all of that other stuff.
Like,
is such a
mess.
Like,
if that magical thing existed where it was like, you just write a book and you hand it away and then it does magically well. And you
if
don't
you
have
were
to
Nora
do
Roberts, you mean.
You don't have to interact with the process at all if you don't want to. That would be perfect. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it works. So I'm a controlling type A achiever. So I gotta drive, and I gotta do it this way. But I mean, like, that all of the rest of it is worth it because the writing is so good. And I think that's where it becomes, you know, when people get like they're so burned out on writing, and they're burned out on publishing, and they're not really in love with the genre, or they've fallen out of love with the genre. I think that's when it becomes more difficult. I don't want to say problematic, because that's a really different word, but like difficult.
Yes.
You know, like, I think you have to love some part of the process.
Oh,
or else you're like, it's too hard. It's too hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I think I 100% agree. I don't necessarily agree that my favorite part is the writing part, which
yes, right. That's true. Not everyone is, like, some people are like, I hate the writing. I'm like, you do?
I mean, my relationship with my writing is very complicated. How about that? But what I would say is that I think that the genre, I think that there is a piece of the puzzle that is about craft. And I think, one, people don't think very much about the idea that romance requires craft and skill.
Yeah, outsiders.
Sure. To pull it off. And I think that sometimes, especially now in the world that we are living in, where it does really feel like publish or perish, for all of us, but I think especially for people who are independently publishing and like have to put out a book to put food on their table. I mean, I do too, right? But I'm, as a traditional published author, as you know, like the money is different. It comes in different at different times in different ways. And I think that often people are concerned about putting books out so fast. And I mean, I'd be interested in hearing you say this, because I feel like there is a sort of constant pressure for you all to publish as fast as you can.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure is there. So here's the difference.
And there's a balance, right, between craft and and time. And they are at odds sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it just depends on, I mean, you and I were briefly talking about strengths before this.
Yeah.
And so my brain is built for speed. And part of the problem that I had in traditional publishing was, you know, Avon didn't want to put out a book more than every 9 months.
Sure.
And that's why I ended up with a second pen name, was because then they put out another book every 9 months. And so then I would end up with 2 to 3 books a year. And that was amazing. The max that they were ever going to do
for
me.
This is amazing.
Yeah. Right. So, and I can write comfortably and also at a high enough level.
Yeah.
6 to 7 books a year. And when I really get going and I get really excited about a project, I can put out 8 or 9 good books a year.
That this is amazing, but very rare. I mean,
right, extremely rare.
Exceedingly rare.
Like it's a weird brain. I don't recommend it to anyone.
No, I mean, I can and you can name a handful of writers, you included, who are clearly writing at the top of their game and writing fast. But I think
that pressure system is built for us.
Are panicking.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is that people, so that of course amounts to a really nice level of success, just in that you can produce a lot, and then that you know, you end up backlist pushes frontlist.
Sure, sure.
The magical, like, whatever the math problem is. The problem becomes that then everyone thinks that they have to do that. That becomes the highest value.
Right.
And everything in the system is geared toward that. And like,
well,
said,
that's
not,
the thing, right?
Like, and these, that's the problem.
The list, the algorithms, how you get pushed to readers. I mean, it's panic inducing.
It is. And it is a deep problem in our industry, and in particularly in our genre, I think. And
I think
my
too.
Fear of it is, I mean, a person like me, it's not that writing process or even that publishing process that burns me out. It's when things come in that are external. So, you know, I mean, something external comes in, it starts shoving stuff off my plate.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with writing and publishing.
No.
Really. And so, but like for a lot of people, they're sitting there trying to pile things onto a plate that can't hold that many things. And that's why we get burnout. And that's why we get people that just one day give up, because it's too hard.
It's too hard to write a good book, period.
It ends
up
being
the
gatekeeper.
And then on top of it, it's writing a good book, publishing it correctly, making sure that you're doing it fast enough so that you're up in the algorithms, making sure
it look right,
your newsletter has enough people. It's just a mess.
Yes. And then that's the other thing too, is that, you know, I mean, it's like, well, just publish an indie, and it's hurt, you know, people say it so many times. And the problem becomes that it's like, but it isn't just writing and publishing, you know, it isn't just, I write a book and I give it, and then somebody else is managing the editorial process. Someone else is managing, I mean, it comes back to you, whatever, but like, you're not managing that process. Like, you give that book to your editor, and one day they send it back to you with edits, and you go, okay, but you don't have to manage that process, right? You don't have to manage the process of a cover. You don't have to manage that process.
No, and it sounds like indie, it sounds awful, frankly.
Right. And there are some people that are really built for that. And also, I have the massive privilege of having the financial ability to do it,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be able to do that. And my husband works for me full time. Again, privilege. So it becomes a privilege system, which it's, I mean, of course, it's a privilege system because here we are. But
it's publishing. Yeah,
it's publishing one way or the other. And I think that there's the capacity for more equity and for, you know, people to come in with a story that traditional publishing wouldn't take for whatever reason. And then they can actually produce that book, and that book can do very well, and they can have financial and, you know, critical success with it. But it's very difficult watching people trying to run the race that their brain isn't built for.
Yes.
And it's a race that they ultimately can't win.
Yeah. I mean, we have also, you and I have been around long enough to see a lot of authors disappear.
Yeah. Because, and it isn't because they changed their name. It's because they just, like, it killed their creativity.
Like, they didn't want it anymore. And the thing is that as much as I don't like the writing of it, there are definitely moments where I wouldn't give any of it up. And I think that when it gets to the point where you just can't find any joy in it, you have to walk away. Yes. And the stress of it, especially now, like, mm-hmm. I feel like this year has been for people like you, probably have written more this year than everyone else. But
yeah, because this is how my brain manages stress.
Yeah. But I think, like, for me, it's been a real slog. It's been like pulling teeth. And at the end of, you know, at the end of 2020, I had looked back and I'd written a number of things, you know, because I try to write like one big book and at least one small thing every year. But this year writing really felt hard because we're living a national trauma.
Yep. And we're all being expected to pretend like it's normal.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
And everyone is trying to pretend like it's normal, and it's not normal. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I really hated seeing people because there were, it felt like there were two reactions. So it was like, don't fucking tell me that you're able to write, which is like, yeah, but for some of us, this is literally, yeah. Like, I would have died if I had not written. Like, yeah. I could not have managed it. Like, the stress would have been too much. Mm-hmm. And then there's the, I need to write and I need to just push myself to, I need to just get through this and just do it. But it's like, but if your brain isn't built for that, that's not possible. And I'm not sure that either one of those reactions was necessarily the best one.
Well, I mean, I think that there, but again, this goes back to it being romance rather than other genres. Like, I think in romance, this is the thing, right? It goes back to me saying we think about the job differently.
Yes.
And that's also because of money, right? It's because this is food on our table and we have to write the book to make the money.
Yep.
And I think that romance and thrillers to a certain extent, and sci-fi maybe, I think we all do kind of think about it as like, this is how I pay my bills.
Yeah.
Which is a different kind of experience, I think, than, you know, yes, certainly my friends who write litfic do not think to themselves like, this is how I pay my bills.
And I think that there's something to be said there's writers of all levels that listen to this podcast. I know that. And so if you're at the beginning and you're not paying, embrace the joy of that.
Because, That's true.
It's so nice. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that this is how they pay their bills. This is 100% how we pay the bills in our house because he works for me.
And
like, this is it, you know, and there's a different level of pressure with that.
Yeah.
Action. Just because, you know, I mean, there's not an option. I, you know, said to my therapist, I was like, I would like to take the summer off. And she's like, why can't you? And I'm like,
yeah, because this is how I pay my bills.
Amazon algorithm exists and I also have to pay bills and people have an expectation. And I tried to do that one time. And it's like, okay, no.
I mean, I do think I think that if I could say two things to people who are early in their career, who are just starting out or like just trying to figure out how they're writing, the two things would be, one, like, enjoy the debut, because enjoy the first book that you write, because you don't know what you don't know.
Yes.
And there is a lot of joy in just writing yourself into corners and then figuring out how you're going to get out of them later. Like, when you're in the corner.
Right.
Rather than now, when I, you know, I'm in chapter 5 and I make a mistake, I'm smart enough about the process to know that this is going to really screw me in chapter 22 if I don't fix it now, right?
Yeah, right.
So one, that's the one thing that I would say. And then the other thing is this idea of like, it's hard for everyone in its own way. Yep. You know, some people are able to sit down and write 10,000 words a day. I've never done that. But, you know, some people, those people have to struggle with, you know, some other piece of the puzzle.
Right.
And I do think, like, the one thing that we could all do better at, those of us who are writers for a living and who, you know, enjoy some modicum of success, I think we could all do better at demystifying the muse piece. You know, there's this general sense that, like, oh, all artists just, like, sit down and the muse comes and it's all just magic. And sometimes it feels like magic, but it's not. Like, it's work.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I think that on Twitter you see more. I mean, I see so many more of us talking about the pain, too. And I really love that because I think it's really easy for people to look at someone who's successful and just be like, it magically happened and there's no pain. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm suffering pain, I must be failing. And it's like, no, you're not failing. You're just in the pain part of the process.
Yeah, that's just how it goes. Like, sometimes it hurts.
Sometimes it hurts. Sometimes you fail. Sometimes you fall. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you think it's going to work and it doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
Sometimes you think it's not going to work and you give up. And then you're like, how did that hit a list?
Yeah.
Like, there is no time in the process where there isn't some level of pain for some. Everyone has that pain. I mean, I remember before I was published, because of course Indie didn't exist because I'm old, and I was complaining to my friend who had been published by Harlequin for a long time, and she said, look, you're either going to suffer before or you're going to suffer after, but you're always going to suffer.
Yeah.
And I was like, at the time I was like, thank you, but I mean, it's always stuck with me. It's like, sometimes it's just sucks.
Mm-hmm. And my friend Carrie Ryan, who is a YA author, likes to say that if you survive in this business long enough, you'll have been on the top and the bottom.
Yep.
And if you can say that you've been both of those places, you're a survivor. Like, you're in it. And I think that that's a big piece of it. And I think you have to be the kind of personality that understands that and can roll with it in some way.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean by demystifying the process, mm-hmm. because I think when we talk about the pain of it, I think oftentimes even when we talk about the pain of it, we talk about it in a kind of mystical way.
Yeah, generalities.
Like, the reality is that literally everything humans do from birth is hard at yep. some point. And, like, you have to learn how to do it all, right? And, you know, my 7-year-old is learning how to tie laces, and it maddens her. Like, she is absolutely irate every time she looks down at her shoe and her shoelace is untied. And, like, I don't think about that. And she's going to learn to tie her shoes, right? And that's what I feel like every – it helps me to think about literally every human skill as at some point having been difficult. If you've learned to play an instrument or to run a marathon or whatever.
Yeah. Even, I mean, you know, you – learning to walk, like, it seems yeah. simple for those of us that have that ability. Like, you just do it. I don't think about, like, how I do it. I just do it. I mean, it's not even almost conscious anymore, and yet you think, like, a child first stands up and they're like, what the ever loving fuck is this?
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to go over there? What the hell, man? I can't do that.
Exactly.
And
I mean, I guess
stagger like a drunken little, you know, person over to you, and they're like, this was horrible, I never want to do that again, and yet exactly. they're gonna do it a billion times in their life.
Exactly.
Yeah
I mean, I guess the difference is that every book is different, so it's kind of like right. learning. You're it's always learning to walk every time,
every single time. Fuck. It's the worst. No, but it's also the best, because, like, that's
yeah process. you've done it before.
Yeah, right. You know a little bit more each time.
I mean, I the hard truth of it is, every time I open a new document to start a new book, I'm like, wait, how do I begin?
Oh, no. Yeah, that blinking cursor, and it's all blank.
And I literally, like, stack up my books, and I read the first page of each one, like, how did I...
how do I start?
What is the beginning?
I always think, this is the one I can't do. I don't think I can do it. Yeah. I don't even want to do it. Oh, my God. It's like, I have 4 words, and I need to get to, like, 75,000. I don't want to do this. I think this is it for me. And then, you know,
I pack it in
25, 30 pages in, and I'm like, okay, now I remember, it's fine.
Yeah.
Couple days of struggle, and then I'm like, oh, right. Unless it's a struggle book, and then I'm like, oh, crap. But, you know, whatever. So what is your actual process, just to demystify that?
Oh,
part?
It's terrible.
Ooh,
don't
I'm excited
do
then.
What I yeah. do.
To have Sarah tell you what to not do. Here we
never
go.
Never go that way. my process is, I do not write every day. I write, I backload my books. So I know when this is another reason why traditional publishing works for me and independent publishing wouldn't, probably, is, you know, I know what my deadline is, and then I know how many weeks/months I need of, like, dedicated writing time to get to it. And I spend about, I would think, probably 3 or 4 months just cooking the book in my head. Mm-hmm. So my process is, when I sell a series to my publisher, I sell the whole series, and I craft, if you've read any of my books, you know that my series are packaged as series. Like, there is a beginning, middle, and an end to each book, and then there's a beginning, middle, and end to the whole series. And you don't necessarily have to read the books in order to do that, but if you do, there's, like, an added bonus to it for you as a reader. So I can't start a series until I know what the kind of big climactic set piece moment is at the end of the last book. It's going to tie everything together. And I can't start a book until I know what that big climactic set piece moment is in the book itself. But other than that, I don't know anything. So that's how it goes. So the way that I describe it to people is, like, imagine you woke up this morning and you had to go to the grocery store in your town, but all the roads you would ordinarily take to get to the grocery store are closed. So, like, you know, the end game is the grocery store, but you have to get yourself there somehow. And that's how I work. And it's terrible. So I usually write about 100 pages and turn them into my editor. And then she gives me feedback that's basically like, here are all the questions I have about this weird thing that you are writing. And then I cook it for a little while. And then I write 3/4 of a book in like two and a half months. So, and my books are about 110,000 words.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you're sort of fast on that back end.
I'm fast once I know.
Once you know.
Well, I write in pressure, right? Like, so yeah. The deadline helps. And then I'm fast once I know kind of everything. But the first 100 pages are a real slog for me, which is why it takes me 9 to 10 months to write a book. Because it could take me 3 months to write 100 pages.
Right.
And then 2 months to write 350 pages.
And then the thinking in between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's pretty collaborative then editorially, just because you need that feedback of like, here's where I'm confused.
Yeah, I mean, I've published 15 books and 14 of them are with her, and so we have a process. Mm-hmm. And she also is a very unique kind of, her process is legendary in the industry. Like, people all know that she works differently than most other editors, and her process is this. I want to see the first 100 pages, because her concept, her idea, and like what she has taught sort of ingrained in me as a writer is that if it's not all there in the first 100 pages, it's not all there and it needs more work. And so that's helpful to me, right? I mean, her whole, the romance adage of like the first page sells your book and the last page sells your next book is really activated by her. And so for me, that first 100 pages really has to be on lock.
Yeah.
Which is why it is the hardest for me.
Well, it's such a weird thing at the beginning because you don't know them. Even if you are like a super preparer, I don't think, well, I don't know. This may be different for other people, so your mileage may vary. But like I do a character sheet and I plot, not, I'm like kind of a planter, but I don't know them until they move around together.
Yep.
And
I mean, I'm, so, yeah, 100%. I mean, I don't believe anybody who says they know their characters absolutely from the very start. Like, that feels, I mean, surely some people do, but that feels really wild to me. Because that's why, you know, there's often one of the hallmarks of a Sarah McLean novel is that, like, at the end, about, you know, 70% of the way through, there's a secret revealed. And invariably, that's because I didn't know it either.
Surprise! Surprise, Sarah!
And like, people are often like, oh, they're so, like, Sarah's books have twists. And it's like, well, yeah, but are they really twists if I didn't know about them? If we all get there together?
I'll tell you, I was just as surprised as you were.
I mean, I was. And so, and that seems to work for everyone. So I'm not going to knock the process. But
right.
I really wish that I were the kind of person who could wake up every morning, sit down at my desk, you know, bang out 1500 words and then like go about my day.
Yeah.
But I'm not. So, and I do fine. So if that is also your process, I'm sorry for you.
There's a support group.
You can always come sit next to me.
Right.
But you'll be fine. There is no right way.
Yeah. And I love, that's the thing I really love about doing this podcast is that, this is episode 96 that we're recording right now. And almost all of those episodes are with writers. There's a couple with editors. There's one with my cover models for a book. And then there's a few where it's just Michael and I, although I suppose I am a writer, so never mind. Wait, I am a writer. But every single one of them has a different process. Like, there's no one that has the exact same process, you know? And so it really shows you that there is no right way to do this, that the only right way is the way that works for you, that gets you to the end of a book. Like, that's how it's right.
Exactly.
If it's not working, then try something else and you'll find it eventually. But there's like 1,000 different ways.
Yeah. And this is my this is my side eye of every like workshop or everything that is like, here's the way you do it. Mm-hmm. Because there just isn't. I mean, you and I have been around for a while and everybody we know writes differently.
Yep. And I think it's always great. And that's the thing is that, you know, I mean, you could come in and you could teach this method, which it doesn't sound like you wish to do. But if you wanted to, you could.
This is not a method, Jess. If I made that seem like generous? A method.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolute. I mean, like, I do not. If you took notes on that method, please throw them out. Burn them. Sage the room.
Start over. Buy a new computer and just start over.
Literally, like. I don't talk to anybody. I don't, you know, I'm completely unhealthy for those last 2 months. I do nothing but am chained to my desk. It's awful. I hate it.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Right.
Don't do it my way.
Okay. So not Sarah, but you know, I mean, there are
but
people
you can teach your method, let's
right,
say.
Right. And that's the thing is that I can teach my method and for some people that will resonate and that's awesome. Like, I love that. And I've become more and more careful as I've gotten to be more and more of an old that it's like, look, I'm going to tell you how I do stuff. And for some of you, you're just going to check out and that's totally cool because it's not going to work for you and it's fine.
Yeah.
So please, you know, like if you can take one thing from it and you can adapt it. Awesome. Do that. If you can take
exactly.
If you can pick up the whole mess and drop it into your cart. Great.
Exactly.
But if it doesn't mean anything to you and you want to just like play Merge Mansion on your phone while I talk, like that's cool too.
Yeah. My husband, when we had a baby, and our daughter was, you know, just born. When you have a newborn, anybody who's ever had a child or been around a newborn knows that literally everyone wants to give you advice. Like, this is how you should how you should handle a baby. And it's excruciating. But also, Eric used to say all the time, listen to everybody's advice because at some point in the middle of the night, while she's screaming, that piece of advice is going to work one time.
Right.
Right? And so it's like, well, if I hold her like this, it won't work again. But it'll work that one time while she's screaming. And then the next time you'll like, you know, go through the file folder of advice that you got from well-meaning strangers and come up with another thing to stop her from screaming. And I think that's how I manage all my books is like, well, this is a screaming baby.
What if I hold her upside down by her toes this one time?
Exactly. Like, what if I do an interview with my main character the way J.R. Ward interviews all of her characters?
Right.
This one time. Will mm-hmm. that help?
Yeah. If I'm stuck, how do I unstick? And that my system isn't working.
Yeah.
System is.
How does Jess do it?
For 5 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah. Will that help? And invariably the answer is no, you're screwed.
But do you think that part of the reason why maybe it does work is because it kind of switches the switch off in your mind and allows you to it almost like makes your brain work in a different
yeah.
direction for just a second. And then your brain goes, oh,
sure.
Wait, I know.
Yeah.
So maybe that's
yeah,
it.
About sometime mid-pandemic, I don't know, during the last eternity, there was like this advice going around that if you were stuck, you should write in Comic Sans.
I can't make myself try it.
Right? So I was like, well, I in fact am stuck, so I'm gonna try this, and it worked for about an hour. And then I was like, why the hell is my manuscript in this dumb font?
It hurts my head.
And then it no longer worked. But I do think, like, you know, it was fun for, you know, an hour.
It's almost
just
like a
try
reset
something
button.
Different. Sure,
yeah,
like, you do.
Button.
You're right. It gives you permission to not be anxious for that amount of time.
Not overthink
it. I feel like I'm being very down on the job. It's not as terrible as I'm making it out to be.
But I think there is a value in talking about the fact
I'm just
that
looking at typeset pages today. So like,
right.
So I'm like
you
in
on
a particular place where I'm very tired of reading this stupid book.
Right, because you're like, by the time you get to typeset pages, you've seen this book so many times that you think, maybe
yeah.
I should rewrite the ending and they all die.
Yeah.
Do I really want to write romance?
Exactly.
Could they be hit in a bus in the Regency period? Was that a possibility?
Too many times. Like, you just can't imagine anybody would ever want to read any of these sentences. And I got into bed last night. By then. And my husband was like, how is it? And I was like, well, the sentences make sense. And he was like, great.
And again, there's like a certain level of experience that tells you, I hate all of this, but I can't, like, I am not, I can't judge it. So I'm just going to go ahead and try to be normal about it and just like not rewrite the whole thing because I hate it. Like,
no, I mean, if you're anything like me, when you get to this point, you're like lucky to find a few sentences that make you, that like, you even like. That you, where you're like, oh, that's nice. You know?
Yeah. You've read it so many times, so, and you're like, well.
And then I you suck. Just, and then the wild thing is, so the wild thing is, it doesn't exist until somebody else reads it. Right? Like, and it's such a weird job in that
it's
way.
It's the weirdest job.
I have spent a lot of time with comedians in my life, and for, you know, reasons. And one of the things that is fine, I'm not a comedian. I would like everyone to know I've never done this, but I've spent some time with them. And comedy is one of those weird things, right? Where the work, it literally cannot exist without an audience. Like, you don't know if the joke lands until you've told the joke. And I feel like that is the closest experience to writing that I can come up with, at least, again, genre. I think it is different if you're like a poet or a, I feel like that experience is, can be very sort of self, like inward focused. But I think in genre, right, our work is entertainment. And so we can't know if the book is entertaining until somebody's read it. And so I think a lot about the comedians that I know and how hard it must be to stand there and watch people read.
Oh my God. Right.
Book, yeah. Right. Like, 'cause I don't have to, I can just like close my eyes and look away.
And in fact, it's better that you do. Like, that's
this it week. It sure it seems exist. That way.
It doesn't exist until someone reads it, and then it no longer belongs to you. It belongs to them.
Yeah.
Like, the story doesn't exist until they have it, but when you let it go and it goes to them, it has almost nothing to do with you anymore.
And it's really hard. I will say, if you're early in your career, it's really hard for those first few books for it not to feel personal. I mean, it always feels personal when somebody
it'll hit you sometimes the wrong way,
right? But it feels personal in a different way later, I think, in your career. It feels like, it doesn't feel like, oh, it's me they hate. It's just this thing I made that they hate is a different thing.
By that time, I'm on to like three things beyond it. So I'm like, I don't even remember who the fuck those people are.
I mean, that's part of it too. But I think I think that is the one difference between like comedians, actors, like people who like literally know in the moment how things are landing. But books are they're a different beast. And it's not like making a movie where you're doing it collaboratively with like, you know, 200 other people. And it could just be that, you know, the heroine, like the lead actress is just not great at her job. Right.
The lighting was bad. When it's the cinematography
just you bad. Alone in the world. And so I think that is something that I think a lot, that is a thing I think a lot about, is like the book doesn't exist until someone else has it.
Yeah.
And somehow that gives me a lot of like comfort. Like, it's not me.
The way you dissociate a little bit.
It's not my problem. It's their problem.
No, it's your problem. Just going to move on with my life.
I mean,
good luck.
I don't know. Read another book.
Take this screaming baby.
Exactly.
I've done all I can.
Exactly. I don't know if that's comforting to other people, but I do. It's very comforting to me.
I think it's a really good point because, you know, I mean, this last week we've seen
some real bad behavior.
Oh my Lord in heaven, some bad behavior. And it is some, like, I remember probably three books in, I had to stick a sticky note on my computer that said, they're not wrong. Because, like, how you react when you read a book isn't wrong. Like, you can hate my book. It's okay. Like, you're allowed to hate my book. Like, you're allowed to think it's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I don't love it when someone says, like, and she just doesn't give a shit. And it's like, well, you don't actually know that because I give a lot of shits. Like, if you don't like the book, that's cool. But, like, you don't have to necessarily come directly at me. But, again, like, I have no, it's none of their business. You know, it's not, it's none of my business, I guess, that's how they feel. And it took, like, that's the one thing I think I'm actually healthy about is I don't look at reviews at all. I have to look at them a little bit more because I, you know, independent. So when I do the NetGalley, I'm the one, you know, dealing with it. So I have to kind of see them, but I really don't make any effort ever to go on Goodreads or look at reviews on Amazon or, you know, like, right. I just don't because it's
theirs
now.
I think that's smart. I mean, I think, look, the reality is that all of us end up on Goodreads or Amazon at some point.
There are nights, yeah.
You know, looking through, you know, our fingers at...
And finding the lowest ones. And it's always, you know, it doesn't matter if there were 5-star ones before it that are like, this is the best book ever. This is her best book. That's a 1-star. It's like, she sucks. I'm like...
Sure. It's that Pretty Woman moment where she's like, the bad stuff is easier to believe. Like, 1,000%. And so, you know, certainly. But at the same time, you know, the book... There are 5 good reviews for every bad one,
mm-hmm.
right? Unless you're this person, this terrible person on the internet this week. So, I mean, I think, you know, I do think that there is a piece of it where readers really make the book happen.
Yeah.
And that's, like I said, it's helpful for lots of reasons. It's helpful for me to dissociate right from the work and have negative reviews or like negative feedback feel less personal. But also it's helpful because it reminds me that my job is to entertain as much as I can, like to do the very best that I can to make readers happy.
Yeah.
And I think that when you think of it as a service job rather than a personal job, for me at least, that's, and this probably has something to do with my strengths, I don't know. But when you think of it that way, it's my woo, it's 5 woo. then you're able to sort of think of it as like, well, sometimes I do go to a restaurant and I don't like it. I don't like the food.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Which is fine. There are lots of other restaurants.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's been easier. I don't know if you feel the same way, but during the pandemic, I have felt the service aspect of it more because there are more people that are saying the only thing getting me through this is reading romance because I know it's going to be happy and I know it's going to be okay. And, you know, I mean, I know that even if I read something that's harder, more emotional, that it's going to be okay in the end, it'll work out. And so I feel like I have felt that service a little bit more genre wise in the last year and a half than probably ever before. Because it usually, I'm sure you get the same thing. It's like you get people that write a nice email that say, I really enjoyed the book. And then every once in a while you have someone that tells you a really personal story about why they connected to the book. And you in that moment realize that like something you did actually meant something to them on a different level. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I see more of that in general and specifically in the last year because people are struggling so much. And so if I am suffering a little bit more writing a book because this is hard this year especially, that's okay because like in the end it's going to help more people. So
yeah, I think that's true. And I think romance is always that for readers. I think we talk on our podcast on Fated Mates about how romance really is one of the rare spaces where romance is a genre of emotion, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it's one of the rare genres where the emotion is about relationships, like about other people.
Yeah.
And so I do think that readers of romance are more connected in many ways to authors. Like I think they care more about us and they assign more, they are more aware of the work that we do in relationship to them. And I think that that's part of why maybe I think about it as a service job. I just know that thriller readers don't write to thriller writers the same way. They don't get the personal emails the way we do.
Yeah.
And I think that's because we're writing stories of hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And overcoming and mm-hmm. joy.
Yeah.
Like there's no story of mine that I've ever written that doesn't end with joy. Not
exactly.
Just hope. Like there's hope throughout and then there's joy. Like it's okay. It's going to be okay. And I think people needed to hear it's going to be okay this year. It's going to be okay.
Yep.
And
someday.
Someday.
We're getting there. Today. It's going to happen. It's going to be fine.
But, you know, at some point, it's, you know, and even if it's only for a little while, because, of course, it's life. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the book where it's like, and then they lived happily ever after. We never heard from or saw them again, except as secondary joyful characters in other people's
exactly.
stories.
And they never die.
They never had, you know, anything right. to overcome.
Right.
Again.
Right. I do think that that's part of why I like writing historical so much. I wrote my first contemporary last year, and I really loved writing it because it was just something. It was like a quarantine project. Mm-hmm. But part of why I really have a lot of joy writing historicals is because the stories can be really extra, right? Yeah. The characters can be really extra, and the conflict can be really big and extra. And so you can really hammer home that idea of happily ever after. Like, they really can triumph. And I think that's something that historicals and paranormals do as a matter of course, by virtue of the genre conventions. And I think contemporaries are often bound by more realistic constraints. At least, you know, straight contemporaries. I think obviously, like, dark romance is not doing that. Talk about extra. But
extra.
And erotic is also able to do. I'm reading Nikki Sloan's Filthy Rich American series right now, and I'm like, okay, Nikki knows what's up when it comes to extra. But I mean, if anybody has ever followed me on Twitter or like followed any of the books that I love, because I talk about romance novels all the time everywhere to anybody who will listen, they know that, like, I'm very into extra. So
There's something so fun about that, like, super soapy, over the top, ridiculous, yeah, outrageous, crazy, like, what just happened.
It's aspect. Joyful. It's,
yeah, it's fun.
Fun. It's, you know, if you love Marvel movies, if you love things that blow up, you know the experience of just loving a character in a romance novel who just is over the top.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if you met them in real life, you'd be like, no, it's,
oh,
it's,
you're
too much.
Really too far out.
You're a lot. You're so far. So much.
Oh, but that's why I love all those heroes who are just too much. Just absolutely too much.
Yeah.
And I am always amused when people are like, but it's so unrealistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I know. Thank you.
I would absolutely.
That's what I was shooting for.
I would definitely call security if any one of these men turned up in my life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Knee to the balls, pepper spray in the eyes, running. Like, no. But on a page, I like it.
Exactly. Leave me alone. Let me have my nice things.
Yeah. Like at the beginning of the pandemic, 365 DI.
Oh, I just watched that this week.
Isn't it insane?
Oh, my God.
It's so much. But, like, I remember just thinking, like, I'm so into this right now. And if someone ever did that, I would escape. I wouldn't be at all attracted to this. And yet...
It's bananas. And then it's literally, and with absolutely no interest in reality, like, none. And I love that. I love it, you know? Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that people don't understand when they come to romance, or they, like, peek through the curtains at us. They're like, it's so weird.
Right, because they always pick the most bananas book.
But also,
to,
like,
do it with.
Literally no one has ever said, like, well, Jack Reacher seems just unrealistic,
exactly.
Right? And I
Thank
do think
you.
That when you say that out loud to people, they're like, oh, I get it. Oh, okay, I get it. They once you sort of compare it to Jack Reacher or, like, Stephen King, and you say, like, you don't ask
Stephen King how he researched his murder scenes.
Exactly. Like, Jack Reacher travels the world with, like, a toothbrush and, like, a killing machine, and no one thinks twice about it, right? Right. He's a one-man terrorism, like, combat unit.
Yeah.
And nobody cares. Like, and we all sort of respect that. And obviously this is all about patriarchy too, but the reality is that most people with heads on their shoulders, when you say, like, this is the comparison, they understand and start to think about the genre in a different way.
Do you feel like too, I mean, I know you write a lot of, I suppose people would consider them feminist characters in historical romance, and I feel like I write extremely strong heroines, and yeah. I hear a lot, you know, like, it's not very realistic for the time.
Sure.
And I mean, it's the same thing. It's like, you don't really know, A.
Well, but it is realistic. I mean,
yes.
I think that that's the thing. I think people want history to look a certain way. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
They want it to seem a certain way. And the reality is that, like, women have been badass for millennia. Yeah. And so is it true that there would be, you know, 14 women in the same family who are all badass? Probably not. But
yeah, but there's not going to be 10 dukes that are all best friends and hot either. And, like, welcome to
every one of them with abs of steel.
All of them have abs. But do you know how you get abs?
Straight,
it involves the gym.
Straight
I asked
white
one of the cover
teeth.
Models.
Straight white
like,
teeth
how do you
and
get
abs
those?
Of steel.
And
no.
He's like, I do a lot of work at the gym. And I'm like, so you definitely wouldn't have had those in 18.
I mean, no, they just, he rides his horse once a day. And
yeah.
It's like magic abs.
Every once in a while.
And
he
looks
out.
Like Henry Cavill.
Yeah, of course. And that's the thing is, like, it is very, very telling what certain populations of our readership are willing to suspend disbelief on.
Yeah.
They're willing to suspend disbelief on teeth,
on straight
and
white teeth and abs.
And cleanliness.
Oh, no one has
abs.
Ever peed in one of my books, Jess.
No.
I'm proud of it. Like, yeah. No one is ever going to pee
no.
in one of my books.
Yeah.
The day I write a peeing character, that is the day that I just pack it in.
If anyone ever pees, then you know what? You know that thing on the internet where it's like, how do you know if someone's been, like, kidnapped? That's it.
That's
I've been
it.
Kidnapped
there it
if
is.
Someone goes to the bathroom in a book. And it's not just to, like,
exactly
marvel at the tub. Like,
exactly.
If a chamber pot comes out.
Nope.
Call 911. I am in trouble.
In fact, I just read a book. So one of my favorite books of last year was Adriana Anders' Whiteout, which is a romantic suspense. Talk about extra. I mean, like, that's another genre, subgenre that I really love for that reason. And the book is set in Antarctica on, like, a base, an Antarctic, you know, base station. And there's, you know, a group of bad guys and a virus that's been, like, found in the ice. And these two people have to trek 250 miles across Antarctica together to get to what they think will be safety. And
it's very extra, by the way.
I mean it's
I think it's on my Kindle. I'm
so much fun. It's actually I don't know when this podcast that we're recording is going to be out, but the podcast, we did a whole episode on this particular book, and it will likely be out around the same time. It's next week's episode. So if you are interested in this and you want to listen to The Fate of Mates, like, deep dive on it, it's probably out by now. Anyway, but during the process, so I guess when one of the rules of Antarctica is no waste, like, it's essentially everything that comes out there has to be packed away, and, like, what you carry in, you have to carry out, including body waste. So these two are running across the continent, and but he's a scientist, and he's, like, very concerned that they, like, while they are running 250 miles across a frozen tundra from bad guys and very likely going to die in negative 40 degree weather, that they also take care of their waste. And so this is the only way I want to see peeing in a book, right? Where, like, it's like, we're on the run from six different terrible things. We're for sure going to die, but let's make sure that when we pee, like, we're taking care of it. And it was totally, it's like the only time anybody's ever peed in a book where I was like, yes,
yes.
This is important. I'm for it. Right?
Right? Yeah.
But anyway.
No one ever pees after sex. No one ever. Like, come
but
on.
Going back to what you were saying, like, no, there is a subset of readers who will accept all of those things and
but
not accept, like, what the world looked like, or that women could be, you know, women could go out on their own without a chaperone. I get a lot of emails about chaperones.
Yeah, I get a lot of emails about chaperones and sex.
Oh,
like, no one invented
sex emails,
just
but
so you know,
write,
until 1980.
You write, you know, erotic. I mean, maybe you do. I don't know. I mean, maybe you do get more than I do. I don't get, and I also get a lot of emails about swear words.
Yeah, I get the swear words. I occasionally get the, you know, well, I would have enjoyed this if she hadn't said, they hadn't used the word fuck, and I want to respond like, fuck yeah, I get what you're saying.
My but response is actually, myself. I do, I have a canned response about the word fuck because I use it in my books too, and I always get emails. And my canned response is that it is from the 1300s, Middle German. So it's been around and it's historically accurate.
Yeah, I like that. I like concern. That. Like, call it, just call it out for the historical accuracy and not the, you used a naughty word.
I take historical accuracy exceedingly seriously, Jess.
In this instance, for sure.
In this one instance, like in many other instances, I'm like, no, she's definitely not wearing that bonnet that she would be wearing because that is hideous. Yeah. I mean, now I'm writing in the 1840s, and if you've looked at any dresses from the 1840s, you know that they are hideous. So I have scrubbed them all out of my books.
We just don't talk about gowns.
Oh, no, I talk about them, but I describe them in absolutely like the way that they surely would have been like tossed out of the ballroom for wearing something so out of fashion.
Well, it is really funny because it like the historical accuracy police, and they don't police me as much anymore because I write full out wallpaper historicals. You want wallpaper historicals, like, come to me. Like, I care about historical accuracy. I'm not going to drive a bus through Regency England, but I am more driven by the characters and the emotion. And so, yeah, like, you know, she's probably going to go out without a chaperone sometimes. And the challenge of that is saying, like, how do I make that make any sense? Like, I don't know that I have to make it make complete 100% historical accuracy sense, but I want it to make sense in the story of, like, why is she so, you know, like, why is she so free? Because if she's so free, like, maybe nobody gives a shit about her, and that seems like a really good character motivation, so I'll take it. But exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I am full-on embrace the wallpaper. And so because I have written more wallpapery historicals for a long time, I think that I have just eliminated the most of the historical accuracy police. I mean, like, they just don't come to me.
I don't get feminist, you know, your characters are too modern emails anymore. I did for a long time. And then I think readers were just like, oh, I don't like her books because her characters are too modern. I stand by my characters, you know, mostly. This new series is pretty, these girls are pretty modern. but I think that's the thing. I also think, like, my politics have been so public in real life and also in the books over the last, you know, 5 years, that I've lost a lot of those readers. Like,
yeah, me too.
Those readers have really been cut out of my readership, but I've gained more than I've lost. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think the books aren't for them.
Right. That's okay. Every book isn't for you.
Yeah. I mean, I also literally mean I didn't write them for them.
Yeah. When I occasionally, very, very occasionally get, you know, someone that doesn't care for the politics, then I think to myself, well, I don't really care if you buy the book. So
I mean,
guess we're even.
I do think that there is, I think at this point, like, if I have not gotten one of those emails in a long time. But I think that if I were to get one of those emails at this point, I'd be like,
have you read the books?
Hi, have we met? Like,
are you confused? Are you new?
Exactly.
Is it generally, to be fair, it's someone that's new.
Like,
it's,
I mean,
someone
that usually
has, I've never read her before, and I hate her, and I hate everything she does now because she has too much sex in the books, or she, you know, she's clearly a raving liberal, and I'm like, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Both of those things. And I'm going to be celebrating the fact that you said sex, sex, sex. This book is only sex, because I'm going to tell you it is going to move some
exactly
product.
Helpful. One star.
Thank
his head,
you.
My favorite review I've ever gotten. One star. His head was under her skirts the whole time.
That's me. A beautiful
click. Oh. Helpful. Helpful.
Michael said that I should. I've been making some swag. So I'm not. I don't really love swag. I find it very stressful. But I'm making it anyway. And I was making. He said we should do a mug where it says, like, you know, here's the cover of the book, and here's the, you know, 4.4 average on Amazon. Here are my favorite reviews, and it'd be like, one star. All this book is sex. Like, one mm-hmm. star. This book is too modern. One star. Just like put the best
exactly.
one star reviews. I was like, that's a really good idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, right? They're helping, so.
Right, because the people that
great
want,
work, everyone.
Oh,
carry
some,
on.
Some hero up the heroine's skirt the whole time. Like, they're like, sold.
His head was under her skirts the whole time.
Well,
not the
which
whole time.
Which one was
time.
That? Which
I know, everyone's like, which you, book?
Can you share with the audience
that
which
book?
Book
is called The Rogue Not Taken, and it's
go,
a road
everyone.
Trip romance.
Oh, I love Roach.
And his head is, in fact, under her skirts quite a bit inside a carriage. But
that's what a carriage is for.
There are other things that happen, too, with his head and her skirts. There are other things under her skirts at times.
Yeah, really. Like, she missed the lead there. Like, she buried the lead. Although I think the head under the skirts is the lead, to be honest.
I mean,
so whatever.
It's like, this is the greatest review. Thank you.
Yeah. I share those. I love
Like, well, my dream is for that to be like the most helpful review on Amazon.
Oh, I know. Wouldn't that be great? It's like, this is the moment. I've worked for this. I've lived for this. But it also,
sadly, I don't think HarperCollins would let me put it on a book.
Man, that's the only reason why you consider indie, right? You're like, maybe.
Exactly. Exactly.
Put the head under the skirt thing under the cover. That might work for me. Well, this has been super fun, and I'm so glad we finally got to meet, sort of.
Thank
not
you so
person,
much for having me.
This was super fun. Will you tell everybody what your latest book is, or your next book, or both? And
yes.
Where they can find you?
I just finished my Bare Knuckle Bastard series, which is about three half-brothers, bastard sons of a duke, who are smugglers in Covent Garden in London.
Love
so
it.
That book came out. The last book in that series is Daring and the Duke, but you can begin that series with Wicked and the Wallflower. And my new book comes out in August. It's called Bombshell, and it's the first book in my new Hell's Bells series, which is about a Victorian era girl gang who, you know, smash the patriarchy and get people's heads up under their skirts.
Perfection. 1 star.
Yeah. And I'm reading types of pages right now. In fact, I believe I might be on the chapter where his head is under her skirt.
Nice. Well,
connected. So there you go. Exactly. It all comes together.
It all comes together. This is why we do this.
You can also listen to my podcast, which is Faded Mates. It's out every Wednesday. And we talk about romance novels and tropes and why tropes work in romance novels. And also we do deep dives on books that we think are really fabulous examples of how the genre works. And that is with my co-host Jen, who is a critic, a romance critic. So we are the only pair of authors and critics. That's on Wednesdays. It's called Faded Mates. And that's it. That's what you can do with me. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram. More on Instagram than on Twitter, but and see pictures of my dog and stuff.
Which is like the third thing that people want the most out of a romance writer.
I do have a dog. He is pretty sweet. So
yeah. I have to go look because I also have my dog, so now our dogs could be friends. I'll be right over there.
Yes.
Well, thank you again.
Thanks so much, Jess. This was really fun.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.